On this week's show, we look to two unassuming Lewisham streets to augur a few solutions for city housing strife and mull over the merits of self-built architecture.
The panels are all 60 centimetres width. They're bolted together, so there's no cement, no glue. The houses are fitted together with bolts. So because of the design, it was easier for self-builders to make them.
All that coming up today on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle's weekly design show, and I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Also today...
I felt design does enhance people's lives. It's just that they're not understanding how it enhances their lives. So if we talk about a print, it inspires you. It makes you and tells you to do something better tomorrow.
We meet the Singaporean startup design platform that's turning heads in the city-state and beyond. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. First off, we're in London, where, concerned by a growing list for local authority housing in the mid-70s, a group of driven individuals in South London who were taken by the architecture of Walter Siegel pushed for a very first self-built scheme in the city. Documenting the residents and the buildings of two tiny roads in Lewisham, which contain 20 self-built homes, Walter's Way and Siegel Close is a new title by Alice Graham and Taryn Wilku. It's published by Park Books and is as much a study of community as it is a book of beautiful interiors and architecture. I headed to Walter's Way for a tour with the writer and photographer behind the book to explore these singular projects and to pose a question. Is there a future as well as a past to self-building in London?
Hi, my name's Taryn, and welcome to my house. We live on 7 Siegel Close, and we're in our lounge.
I didn't actually know anything about architecture or design, certainly hadn't heard of Walter Siegel, but when I saw the houses, I thought they looked really interesting. They looked really different to most houses in London and very different to the other houses in the area, which are either Victorian terraced houses or there's some quite big Edwardian houses. And these were really different, kind of quite small. They've got a half-timbered look around the outside, which is because they're made of timber, which is bolted together. The houses have got flat roofs, lots of wood, and in Walter's Way, the road has a lot of trees. The houses are raised on stilts, which means that the trees didn't need to be cut down before the houses were built. So we're actually kind of snuggled in amongst the trees rather than in a plain sort of flat environment that's just kind of, you know, tarmacked. We sort of almost like we're close to nature. We hear quite a lot of bird song. We've got big plane trees. We have sort of like shoots from the plane trees kind of like coming into our bedroom window. And certainly when people come to the street, if they're maybe delivering something or if they're a friend visiting, they almost always say, this doesn't feel like London at all. It feels like being in the countryside. Or a lot of people compare it to other places. You know, they say, oh, this reminds me of back home in Jamaica, or this reminds me of back home in Scandinavia, or this reminds me of back home in Canada. It seems to kind of evoke other places. I think that might be partly down to Walter Siegel, because he was European and European influenced architect. He was born in Berlin. He trained with the modernist architects in Berlin. His family were associated with Walter Gropius and the other German architects, designers and artists of the period. His father was an expressionist painting called Arthur Siegel. And Siegel, when he was young, he lived in Switzerland when he was growing up with his family, but they escaped there during the First World War. He also lived in Mallorca, and I think he was influenced by the Balearic style of architecture. And then when he came to London, he initially built some fairly sort of modernist influenced apartment blocks and houses, but it was really only when he was actually doing up his own house, and he built a small hut in the garden, or summer house or temporary building in the garden for his family to live in, that the idea of these timber framed houses developed into the idea of self-build as well. So there's kind of a bit of a development there. If you look at Siegel's buildings that he created when he was a very young architect, for example, the first building he was ever commissioned to design, that looks actually very similar to these buildings in Siegel Close. For example, they've got an overhanging roof, which is a Swiss feature, which weatherproofs the house and is really important. Also, in his early buildings, they are also timber framed and clad. Some of the materials that he used in his first ever building is also in the Siegel Close and Walters Way, and that's wood wool slabs he used, and glazelle boards. So he used those very early on in his career. He must have kept the idea with him, but then it was with this project that he did with Lewisham that he was able to actually create these houses using his ideas.
And I can attest to the difficultness of finding out very much about Walter Siegel as a design writer and as someone coming to interview you about it. He's a fairly enigmatic figure, not as documented or lauded as many architects, but this project is interesting because of his vision, but also because of the way that it came about, isn't it? How the commission ended up being his. Can you tell me a little bit about when it happened and the first foundations for the houses?
It seemed to be like a bit of a perfect storm between certain people meeting. So Walter Siegel was living in Highgate and he designed what he called the Little House in the Garden, which was his prototype for these houses. Then Lewisham Council, they were looking for different innovative ways to provide housing. There was a housing crisis in the 70s. The people at the council were quite receptive to different ideas. So there was Ron Pepper, who was the council leader. There was Brian Richardson, who was head of architecture or deputy head of architecture. And they knew a writer called Colin Ward, who was influential, who was an anarchist writer, who also knew Siegel. And then there was John Broom, who was a young architect at the council at that time, who had known Siegel because John Broom studied the Architectural Association while Walter Siegel was a lecturer there. So the two had met before, and they all sort of came together. John Broom would say it wasn't him that brought them together, but it does seem that he was quite influential. The group from Lewisham Council went to meet Walter Siegel, and they somehow discovered this idea of having a self-build project in Lewisham, which was really unusual. When Walter Siegel designed his houses originally, they weren't designed for self-build. They were actually designed to be built by a professional builder or professional carpenter. However, they were made in a way that it made it easy for self-builders to do it. So they didn't use any wet trades. They used basically timber, wood wool slabs, and weatherproof boards on the outside and plasterboard on the inside. They were made mostly using materials that were readily available and used in the sizes. So the walls all have timber battens at 60 centimetres apart. So the panels are all 60 centimetres width. They're bolted together, so there's no cement, no glue. The houses are fitted together with bolts. So because of the design, it was easier for self-builders to make them. So Siegel, he didn't actually do any self-building that I'm aware of himself. He may have built some furniture and done some carpentry very early on in his career, but he had this little house in the garden and clients. He worked from home. He never worked for a big company. He worked himself based at home, so clients would come to his house. They were interested in having a house built. But when they saw the little house in the garden, which was the timber frame building, they were actually more interested in that than in having a brick-built house built. So then they would ask him to design for them a house in that style. So he designed these houses for some clients. So this was in the 1960s, around the country. And there are still some in sort of home counties and around the UK. But one of his clients actually fell out with their builder. They had a big argument with the builder. The builder left the project. And the client had a phone conversation with Siegel about whether it would be possible for him to actually continue doing the project himself without the builders. And Siegel was quite intrigued by this idea and thought that, you know, it was really interesting, the idea that a client could build their own house. And that, I believe, is how the idea of self-build emerged. So fast forwarding a bit to Lewisham, they had a meeting with Siegel, and there was a lot of negotiation, a lot of bureaucracy that they had to go through to actually be given what they needed in terms of permission, the planning permission, the government funding. So it was funded partly by locally and partly by central government. It took 5 years of negotiations for those to all be in place. And at that point, building can start. The way that the builders were chosen was the scheme was advertised in a council newspaper, which all families got. And people who were interested applied to be on the scheme. And then there was a ballot at the town hall and names were picked out of a hat. And those families were chosen to be the self-builders. Because the negotiations took quite a lot of time, there was quite a bit of movement with the self-builders. So if people, maybe they were wanted to do the self-build, but maybe they were offered a council flat, or they moved out of the area, or they were offered a housing association, place, then they would drop out of the scheme and then new families might come on board. So it did take a lot of time. And then the first scheme was Seagull Close and two other small developments, which were just two houses each. And then the second scheme, which was a few years down the line, was Walter's Way. Both Seagull Close, Walter's Way were named after Walter Seagull, which I think is really nice, because often people don't think to sort of thank their architect, or they may have sort of not particularly want to, but apparently the self-builders actually decided that they wanted to honour their architect by naming the streets after him.
At what point did you decide to become also a documenter of the place that you lived as well as an inhabitant?
The project kind of started, I think, from a conversation we were having amongst the neighbours. It was in 2017, marked 30 years since the death of Walter Seagull. We wanted to somehow acknowledge the work of Seagull. We felt that maybe people would be interested in hearing about the really wonderful houses that he designed. So amongst the neighbours, we were chatting and decided that we wanted to have some kind of special event. We had a special open house event, also pitched the idea of an exhibition to the Architectural Association, which is the institution where Walter Seagull used to teach. And they took on the idea and produced an exhibition, which included some of Taran's photos and some Seagull-designed furniture, because he also designed furniture, had a bit about his background, and also had a reproduction of a Seagull house within the gallery. Following on from the exhibition, the book was the next logical step. In Walter's Way and Seagull Close, we do London Open House every year, and the homes are always popular. People really seem to appreciate looking inside and seeing the street and seeing how it works. With the book, we envisaged something like an open house visit, but written down, so that people who weren't actually visiting could get a sense of the history, the architecture, the design of the house, and also what it's like to live in the houses today. So as well as showing what the houses were like in the past, we interviewed the current residents, and they could talk about how they'd adapted the homes, the changes they'd made, and what it was like to live in. So we produced a book that's part architectural history and part coffee table and design. I think people who are involved in housing, like architects, people who work at the council, people involved in planning decisions, government, and designers, would do well to come and see Walter Seagull's houses here in Walter's Way and Seagull Close. I think they're a good example of how housing can be affordable, but housing that really people really want to live in, and they stay there. I'm not sure if it's been mentioned already, but all of the houses in Walter's Way and Seagull Close have now been sold, and so they're now all privately owned. So although it was initially a social housing scheme, it no longer is. I think it would be really good to have more housing available like this, ideally at an affordable price. I don't think that everyone is going to want to build their own house, or that self-build is necessarily going to solve the housing crisis. But I think it should be an option that people consider. And I think if people come and look at these houses and see that it's possible to have houses that are a bit different to the norm, but people really enjoy living in them, and the people who built them were actually really changed by that experience and found it a really valuable thing to do, I think people should have that opportunity today.
And when you talk about enjoyment and you talk about kind of quality of life, I think it's important when talking about these kind of architectural projects to not talk in the stiff, brisk terms always of urban planners about density and whatnot, but actually to talk about the human side, the embodied experience of living in these places. What's your favourite thing about living in one of these houses? What's your experience and your kind of, you know, what do you think people can learn on an emotional level from living in these kind of houses?
I think the houses are well designed in that they're open plan. They seem to encourage people to come together, both the individual houses and the actual street itself. So with Walter's Way, for example, the families all get to know each other. They all meet in the street. They have social activities together. Because it's a private road, people have certain responsibilities to maintain the street, maintain the street lighting, manage the refuse collection and recycling. That means that people have to talk to each other. It seems to have created quite a community, and I think that's partly down to Seagull's design, and also the shape of the road, the style of the houses seem to have created quite a nice community, as well as just a street of houses. It seems to be more than that. It's actually quite a unique living space.
Writer Alice Graham and photographer Taran Wilkoo speaking to me at Walter's Way, a self-built architecture project in Lewisham celebrating the 30th anniversary of the death of the architect Walter Siegel. Their book is available now and published by Park Books. Time now for an aside and to look at some other news from the world of design. Qatar has a new national library at last. The OMA-designed building has opened to the public in the somewhat greyly named Education City district of Doha. Facilities include computer labs, group study spaces, 3D printing tools and musical instruments. So much for the shushy libraries of yore, we hear you say. Libraries around the world are struggling to react to the internet's many promises, but it's heartening to see a little concrete investment in actual research. And a new book from Thames and Hudson has just been released, documenting the remarkable past of the British pop culture magazine The Face. Between its launch in 1980 and the turn of the millennium, The Face stared down competition with its reporting on youth culture that went beyond music and, dare we say, changed the face of publishing in between. The story of The Face is written by Paul Gorman and available at all good bookshops now. The metaphorical Section D mailbag is always open to suggestions and questions. Do get in touch with our regular producer, Ben Rylan. He can be contacted at br@monocle.com. This is Section D. Do stay tuned. Next up, we stay in London and turn our attention to a pop-up that's spreading some good news about Southeast Asian design. Dennis Tay started his design platform Nice, written N-A-I-S-E, in his bedroom in 2013 with just under €200 in his bank account, along with a little optimism about his native Singapore's budding industrial design scene. Today, his marketplace represents 1,000 makers and designers, 80% of which are from the city-state, and Tay hawks them through a series of 6 shops at home and a space in Malaysia. This month, Tay's brand is visiting London to foster some new followers and flog some well-made wares at East London's Truman Brewery. I sat down with him in studio here in London to find out more about the makings of Singapore's long stagnant but now stirring design scene.
So Nice was founded in my bedroom with a laptop and myself and $3,000. We've bootstrapped the company to where it is today. It's been a long, long journey, but it's been a really fun and interesting one.
You know, when I hear a success story about a company going from a fairly humble beginning to an extraordinary kind of brick and mortar mini empire, it speaks to me of the idea that probably people wanted this service to exist. There were all of these Singaporean designers, Southeast Asian designers, who were kind of crying out for a galvanizing force, a place on which to sell their products. And a platform from which to be heard. Can you kind of speak to that? Were people crying out for this when it arrived?
I think there definitely was that interest. But I think in Southeast Asian culture, design itself, there wasn't really an appreciation for it. When we think about Southeast Asian culture, a lot of them believed that design was a little bit closer to art. And they didn't understand the values behind design. It kind of alienating, I would say, the word, right? So in Singapore, for example, when I first started the company, none of these products existed in the market. So we're talking about really small designers in small little corners, far-flung corners, that nobody ever could find them. And at the same time, designers themselves had the idea that there wasn't a market for it, that at the same time, they were creatives, they didn't want to handle the business side of things. And as a result, that gap really existed. And that's what I felt, because I felt design does enhance people's lives. It's just that they're not understanding how it enhances their lives. So if we talk about a print, it inspires you. It makes you and tells you to do something better tomorrow. It could be handwritten by somebody, but that is that intangible value that design can bring to the table. But customers at the point in time, I think it was always about price. It was always about whether or not it represented a status symbol. And I felt that by bridging this gap, it helped designers reach out to people. It helped them to make sense that in what they're talented and what their creativity can do, it actually has an audience. And at the same time, for customers to then go, this product thus actually improved my everyday life. So it's just about finding the bridge. And definitely in Singapore and in Southeast Asia, these designers and the creatives, they tend to be very, very fragmented. They tend to be on their own. There isn't one big force that is trying to pull all of them together and give them sufficient resource and exposure into mass market, right? So we're trying to really focus and do that well.
And the place you started off strikes me as interesting. You know, you started off in your bedroom, presumably with a laptop. And as you mentioned today, with six stores, this speaks to me kind of the importance of physical retail spaces, of bricks and mortar, as opposed to just being an online platform that spews pictures, images, ideas, kind of at and towards people without ever fully engaging them. In your experience, you know, how important is it to have a physical retail space to catch someone's eye with a tangible product that they can touch?
As we started with purely an e-commerce channel, we then started moving off into pop-ups. And it was during the pop-up stages of the brand that I think we truly discovered the true potential of an omni-channel strategy. We existed selling products that tend to be lesser known. They are products that needed some kind of interaction with. So having physical spaces truly enabled the customer to understand and appreciate the product.
So when you say that, you mean it might be a letterpress that has tangible, nice cards, or it might be a ceramics company. What do you mean that you need the interaction?
So when we shop online, we look at the picture, we look at the price, and we move on. We rarely consume the information behind what is written on the website. But when you have a physical space, customers tend to want to interact with the product. And it also allows for that experience to travel beyond, especially when your retail staff speaks to them about the stories behind it. And in physical retail, in brick and mortar, that stories can flourish. And it becomes a bit more of a discovery than it is just purely trying to look for something. I think the thing about the online shopping experience is that it has become very directed in nature. You know, you go online, you search for a wallet, and you expect a wallet to come out. And then you start to look at the prices and you don't think about the craftsmanship behind. You don't think about how it's created, why it's created. But how it's created and why it's created is actually why you should buy the product.
And I also suppose that the kind of the beautiful serendipity of something catching your eye across a table, or kind of being fascinated by seeing something, not just it popping up as a recommendation at the bottom of a page after you've keyed in the thing that you hastily need to get delivered for the next day. You know, we're talking about storytelling, and I think Singapore itself is quite an interesting story. You know, its foundation and its success has been kind of broadly based on being a financial trading hub, or on people being extremely complicit with the companies that they work for, kind of not breaking too many boundaries, you know, following their parents' expectations. You know, these are broad brushstrokes. But, you know, Singapore's reputation hasn't been for creativity in the past. Is that why there's this huge upwelling and desire to express itself and, you know, have its own sense of identity in the design world?
I think that is very likely one of the possibilities. At the same time, I also think that we ourselves are creative. It's just that we've never been brought up in that culture. And I think by enabling them, and that's what essentially NICE does as a platform, is by enabling the creatives to continue to further develop, is that we start to see a lot of these designers come up from the woodwork, right? We have brands that have quit their banking jobs essentially to start making teas, making crafted goods. And I think the more important thing is sustainability. So in starting NICE, the most important thing that we recognized was, how do we enable these designers to then think about it as a business rather than as a passion project? And once we've been able to establish that, it becomes a natural evolution for them. They start to think about how to scale. They start to think about how to hire the right people. How do we look for better methods of production? So today, out of the 1,067 brands that we carry, 800 of them are actually local brands. So local Singaporeans who had, you know, really cushy jobs, who had were bankers, who were lawyers, who have all decided to leave that corporate life to essentially go out and do something that they truly love and truly believe in. And I think that's really important if we want to continue to inspire creativity within the country.
But specifically, I'd say Singapore is having something of a renaissance towards the small, the independent, and the interesting. You think of books, actually, and their kind of math paper press imprint. You think of the young fashion designers popping up in Holland Village, or all of the multitude of amazing, small, interesting brands. And yet, I sit here with you in London, so far away from your home base and from your six stores. What on earth brings you here, and what role does London play in this kind of international conversation about design, and why on earth would you end up here?
One of the key reasons why we're here is London is actually our second largest international market online. So we've had customers who are in London themselves, and they buy products through our online site. And I think it's to service that customer base, right? So offer them low shipping fees, you know, faster turnaround on the products that they buy. But at the same time, London is a design capital. It's a place where we want to interact with newer designers. We want to help the local community of creatives as well be able to scale into, for example, Southeast Asia, where they might have had issues scaling into. And it becomes a two-way thing. Again, Nice has always seen itself as a creative platform. And we want to enable universally creatives from everywhere in this world to be able to reach out to different markets that they themselves might not be able to. And many of these designers tend to be smaller outfits, 5 to 10 guys, maybe, you know, sometimes maybe just 2. And by enabling them to reach out to bigger markets, they then have that ability to evolve, to think about scaling their or innovating on the products, you know, not having to worry about setting up a business in a different country and all that operational hoo-ha behind it. So London, for us, it was a natural selection. I think the design capital, the international audience that we already have here. At the same time, Singapore was a colony of Britain in the past. A lot of the way in which we operate, the legal rules, the taxation methods, a lot of them tend to be similar. And in our first expansion outwards of Singapore, it becomes a lot easier as well for us to digest in that sense. Because at the end of the day, we need to make sure that the business retains its viability and sustainability. If something were to happen to Nice, that represents that something will happen as well to the other 1,067 brands that we represent. So there's a large responsibility on the shoulders of the company, and we want to make it right for everybody.
Dennis Tay there, the founder of retailer and design platform Nice, which is open in Singapore indefinitely and in London's Truman Brewery until November the 19th. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. Section D was produced by That Bad Penny, Henry Rhys Sheridan, edited by Claire Urban, and researched by Daphne Karnesis. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.